Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Hope your season is going well. Talk a little bit about that very soon. Mine as well. Maybe even a lamentation or two. We'll see. Great show in store for you today. We got one of the experts, probably the expert on bobwhites and blue quail. We'll get some of his tips. We'll understand the birds better so we can become better conservationists and hunters too. Scoot your bird dog up closer to the speaker. He might learn something as well, either from that or for some of the other things we're going to cover today. Reader poll, your hunting reports, our Handle It segment on approaching a pointing dog, maybe even a public access tip or two, all coming to you from the Cabela's podcast studio. Thanks for joining me. Well, I don't know how your season is really going. I'm wishful, of course, and positive. I keep visiting places I've never visited before. This one in the same general region as a few other spots I like in Nevada, but covered all new ground 3 or 4 days last week and learned a whole heck of a lot about the birds. You know, the chukar hunters in particular, we talk all about, well, this time of year, the birds are going to be eating all that greened up cheatgrass shoot and things like that. Looking for water is no longer a problem. Well, it is. It still is, as this is recorded. There's still not much in the way of precipitation in most of the West, and it's affecting the birds' movements, their traditional movements, if you will. Learned that the hard way. Finally found chukars on the only big slope that had a lot of cheatgrass growing on it. Now, this time of year, of course, it's not really growing, and as I said, it's not greening up. The new shoots are not coming up. But there is cheatgrass seed everywhere. In fact, I popped the crop on one of these birds when I brought it home, and it had a golf ball-sized wad of cheatgrass seed, nothing else. In fact, that was its entire diet. So don't believe everything you see, hear, or read, because sometimes Mother Nature has a way of playing a few games with us, and that is one perfect example. Same trip, in fact, same slope up towards the top. Big sheer rock wall and then almost a cave for, you know, about 60, 80 yards. It was the mother of all chukar roosts. There must have been 3 or 4 inches of chukar droppings, a 5 foot wide band that was at least 20 feet long. It was, man, we're going to try and put a game camera up there and see what happens in the afternoon. I know as we were headed down the slope at dark, the birds were headed down the cliff into that hiding place, and it would have been interesting to see how many ended up there. It was epic, to say the least. So anyway, hope you're discovering some new country, and your dog is doing great and is healthy. We'll talk a little bit about that down the road, and that you're having a good time. It's all about the camaraderie, the places we go, the dog work. Oh, yeah, and a bird here or there. Speaking of which, thank you for all your great hunting reports. Patrick States says they got into birds in northeast Colorado. Only put one in the bag, but that's okay. Because Rebel, his German short hair, also got a kangaroo rat. Yeah, watched Flick do virtually the same thing with a little ground squirrel on, coming down off that slope, in fact. Kevin McLaughlin had a pretty good day in Oklahoma. Roosters in the morning and quail in the afternoon. Man, that is what it's all about in Oklahoma. Hope you're taking advantage of that relatively new public access program. I think you call it OLAP out there. We christened a few of those places last time I was out in OK. Tony Arneson says his English setter pup's first Hungarian partridge was brought to bag in Idaho. Great day. She put it all together. Good-looking little dog there, Tony, and good luck with both of those dogs and with all the wonders that come with a brand-new bird dog. Michael Gill, welcome to the fraternity. Michael went on his first chukar hunt, shot a few birds, walked many miles. He says he definitely needs to work on conditioning his dog's feet. How about your own feet, Michael? Chucker ground is hard on them. Yeah, well, I've talked about that. Maybe I'll do some more talking about that down the road. And as we all say, the first time you hunt them is for fun. And Michael's got it right. After that, it's for revenge. Congratulations. And Greg Patek spent the last week hunting walk-in country in Kansas with new friends, human and canine. There you go. What more can I say? Mark Cross, John Salfisberg, Dan Lenson, and Patrick Gilley, thank you so much. Those are great photos. You know, it doesn't have to be an accounting of your trip over the weekend. It can be a great photo from it looks like a selfie taken by Mark Cross's dog to some kind of artful stuff from Dan Lenson that's kind of frosty, etc. So keep it up. Love to see your stuff. So do all the other folks on our Facebook page, Wing Shooting USA Facebook page, or the Upland Nation Facebook page. Either one. I check them both a couple times a day. All right. So just about ready to talk with Dale Rollins from the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. But before we do, a quick reminder, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker, gun care products crafted at the highest caliber. This time of year, several good things happening at sageandbreaker.com. Last minute gift ideas of all sorts for you or for somebody else, or just make your significant other aware of that sageandbreaker.com website. New products, free shipping always. Get more information and learn from all their great videos at sageandbreaker.com. And without further ado, let's get to the main topic today, Bob White's and Blues. No, all quail, no music in there, except that little music in the background. Dr. Dale Rollins joins us. Dale is the executive director of the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation, a nonprofit that focuses on one thing, understanding and managing bobwhite and scaled quail in West Texas. Everything they do, they say, centers around quail and quail hunting. Their mission is to preserve Texas's heritage of wild quail hunting for this and future generations. Joining me on the line, Dr. Dale Rollins. Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast, Dale.
Well, it's good to be with you today. I look forward to it.
You know, I look at it this way. What's good for Texas quail is probably good for quail in Oklahoma and everywhere else that they dwell. And that's why I thought you would be such a great interview and so helpful to all of us who pursue these little birds here and there and probably get frustrated by them most of the time. You know, you've been in this world for a long time. I'm not going to go through the entire CV with you, but you got a PhD from Texas Tech. You were inducted into the Texas Conservation Hall of Fame. My alma mater, Field and Stream, named you a hero of conservation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whew! What brought you to quail?
Well, I would like to think that it was more quail brought themselves to me, and it wasn't so much, it's what I call destiny. You know, I often liken my journey in life to that little white feather in Forrest Gump. And I tell people that, over my 55 years of hunting quail, that little white feather was a bobwhite feather. And, it's been a great odyssey for me, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
What part of it really trips your trigger? I mean, I know what it is for me, but I try to be unbiased and let everybody else answer their question their own way. What is it about that whole thing that gets you the most excited?
Well, I think that changes over a hunter's life. Mm-hmm. I mean, until the time I was 25, I had a bloodlust and I carried a Remington 870, which I thought was the most deadly shotgun for hunting quail. And I wanted to get a bag limit of quail every time I went. Now, 40 years later, it's just not that important to me. I enjoy being with the dogs and being with my friends. And whether or not we kill a single bird or a single limit is kind of just not that important to us anymore. We enjoy the opportunities to relive the memories that we've created on all those minute quail hunts over the years.
Amen to that. And you know, it's funny, it's almost universal. And I think most of the time it is chronological. You're absolutely right. And someday I'll do a whole podcast on that topic, but it is all about the other stuff now, isn't it?
Yeah. I tell people that, that quail hunting is like, it's like MTV, if that's not too old a reference. There's a whole lot of things going on. It's action oriented. You don't have to be quiet. You don't have to be stealthy. You can be poking and prodding at one another and just enjoying all the sights and sounds that make up a good Texas quail hunt.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. All right, so you started with the classic, but let's get the important stuff out of the way real fast. Dale Rollins, is it an over and under, a side by side, a semi auto, or a pump gun for you these days?
It's an over and under these days. I shoot a Ruger Red Label 28 gauge. I've shot that for roughly 20 years now and really enjoy it.
So do I. I love that gun. And I wish I could use it a little more often, but I need a few more pellets in mine most of the time. How about the other important question? Pointer or flusher?
Pointer.
You running pointer. Dogs?
Yes. I have setters, and actually that's not quite a true statement, because beginning in about 1991, I had my first access. I got my first access to a Lou Ellen setter that I called Susie. And I'm very quick to tell people I'm not a dog trainer. I like to give a dog plenty of opportunities to express their genetic potential and then hopefully mentor with one of their parents. And so I got Susie when she was 7 weeks old. Never forget the day my brother-in-law said, come down here and look at these bird dog pups. And I'd been out of the bird dog world for about 10 years. And I said, I don't have time for a bird dog. And I was kind of creeping into the deer world a little bit. But when Susie struck that pose, she stole my heart. And ever since that time, me and my buddy Steve and a couple of other guys, we have developed, I hate to call it a line, but we breed Brittany's and setters, and it's typically about 15 16ths Brittany. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. About 15 16ths setter. So we call them betters. And again, we're not into registered dogs. We're not into field trials. We're into good dogs, and the people that hunt with us will typically ask, did you train those bird dogs? And again, I tell them I'm not a dog trainer, but the ability for a bird dog to mentor and be raised with its mother, its dam, if she's a good dog, that's the biggest part of bird dog training, in my opinion. And so that's been 20 years or 30 years ago now. And so we've still got dogs kind of coming out of that line, and they're very loving dogs. A lot of people in Texas will think that setters just can't hack it. Texas is too tough. Cactus is too much. Got to be a Roman foot soldier. It's got to be a pointer. I don't believe that at all. And the resurgence in setters out in West Texas has been pleasing to see over the last 15 years.
Okay, so I got to ask, why the 1/16th Brittany in those dogs?
Well, again, I started my prototype better. Her name was Little Annie. She was half Brittany, half setter. And her father was a French Brittany. And we liked the way he hunted. We liked the way Susie hunted. Again, we said, what the heck? And the Brittany is a great natural retriever. And so mm-hmm. Doesn't take a whole lot of that in there to really make a difference. And then the setter, you just got the flag. And there's nothing more beautiful in West Texas in the fall. And and a stand of broomweed that's about 18 to 20 inches tall, and you see that flag coming up above that dense stand of broomweed. That's just what I call up periscope.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's so true. It is. Now, if you've been doing this for a while, are you throwing any tri-colored betters, or are they all coming out mainly setter colors?
They're all setter colors, orange and white, typically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess the odds are with that kind of a proportion that's going to happen, that's for sure. So let's start our talk about Bob Whites, and we'll get into blue quail down the road because I want to figure out how to actually shoot a few someday. But first, tell us all about Rolling Plains and kind of give us the 411 on the organization and some of your activities.
Well, back in about 2004, back in 1993, I developed a youth program called the Bob White Brigade. And we use quail as a tool to teach leadership development. And so they spend 5 days learning all about quail and bird dogs and shotguns and all those things to create and instill confidence in them as young leaders. And about 2003, we had a bead on some philanthropists up in Pennsylvania, the Richard King Mellon Foundation. And we had an opportunity to get one of their board members down here and show him what we were doing. They liked the program that they were doing. They've adopted a similar program up in Pennsylvania now. But we also invited two of them down for 3 years of quail hunting, and this would have been about like 2003, 2004, 2005, and those were pretty good years for quail. And so we wanted to grease the skids, if you will, and we did. We showed them three successive days of 30 to 35 plus covey outings. And when I met them, the Mellon Foundation is a big player in the conservation fund down in Florida, mostly of what you might recognize as tall timbers and some of those plantations. And so I first met them, and I wasn't flippant when I said, what you guys need is a ranch from West Texas, and let me manage it for quail for you. Well, about 6 months later, after the season was over, they came to one of the guys that was helping me pull this together and said, we'd like to purchase a ranch and let y'all manage it for quail in West Texas. So that kind of planted the seed. And here in about 6 months then, we located a 4,700-acre property that was subsequently purchased by the Conservation Fund. And then a year later, it was deeded over to the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation, which is a 501c3. And that was in 2006. And so for about the last 14 years now, again, we use that 4,700-acre area to do everything that we can learn about quail. We say that everything at the research ranch points to quail. They're at the apex of everything we do. So if it's subscribe burn, if it's prickly pear control, if it's planting some type of seed or whatever, everything moves in that direction. And it's also used as an educational laboratory. So we've got field days and extension type activities going on all the time and having people out there to demonstrate what the proper landscape for Bob White Quail in West Texas should look like and how to get it there.
Are there any particular initiatives or research projects that we should know about that that could affect us down the road that you're working on?
Yeah. Our biggest research initiative to date started back in 2010. And I have advisory committee that meets once a year. And in 2009, I said, I always ask them for what they think their upcoming forecast is. Do you think it's going to be a 6? Do you think it's going to be an 8? Do you think it's going to be a 2? And one of the gentlemen that was always very spot on with his forecast, he told me, his name is Roy Wilson. He said, Dale, I don't know. He said, I've got to where I cannot make a call. It used to be that we could say what we had out there in July and August and extrapolate that 2 months. and we'd have a pretty good quail season. But then it just became a situation where, again, we didn't feel like we could make an educated guess on it. And so we brought together colleagues of mine from four or five different universities, and our board of directors said, Rollins, you've been saying disease is something that really intrigues you. Get to the bottom of it. Here's the money. We'll burn the furniture if we need to, but let's go whole hog into this disease effort. And so that's became known as Operation Idiopathic Decline. Idiopathic being medical jargon for the doctor don't know. And so a lot of people think there's some kind of disease that comes through about September. They'll blame the dove hunters, but then all of a sudden we'll be seeing quails. So what happens kind of thing. And so we did the old college drive, pulling together studies across 35 counties in West Texas and Western Oklahoma. We involved, like I said, about nine different scientists, and we collected about 2,200 quail. When I said collect, we trapped them and took blood and liver samples and all kinds of state-of-the-art disease testing kind of thing. The biggest thing that came out of that was the dominance of two parasites. First one is called the cecal worm. It occurs down in the lower gut. And the other one is called the eye worm, and it occurs in and around the eye. Now, neither one of those were unknown. They were the eye worm has been the one that has continued to capture most of the attention since that time. And those have been known since at least 1959. But what we don't know is what happened between 59 and 2019. Were there years when the eye worms were really, really bad and others that they're not? So we've continued to monitor that situation, and with the goal of developing an FDA-approved feed for wild birds. And it'll be only the second wild bird feed ever approved by the FDA. And we're very close to that. We think we'll have it ready within the next year. It's got to go through all the chemical auspices and testing and so forth and scrutiny of the FDA. I'm sure the FDA has been busy with the COVID right now, but we're getting closer. And we think if it works as we think it will, we think that this might be one of the real game changers that could be out there. So
wow,
anxious for that. Then our other big effort that we've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years is the translocation of wild trapped quail to points further east. If you know anything about Bob White's, once you get about I-35 all the way to Tallahassee, Georgia, you don't have very many. Now you get down there in the Red Hills region, tall timbers, and they've cracked the code down there. They can raise wild Bob White's, and they can do a good job. It's just expensive to do it because of what the expenses for management are. So those have been our two biggest efforts right now. We do a lot of other things. We do a lot of radio telemetry work. We focus in a lot on predator management, some of the topics that are kind of taboo in today's world, but we focus quite a bit on predation management and being able to document what the worst enemies of quail are, and then try to use habitat management to mitigate the impacts of those to where we can accept, we got to live with predators. I mean, that's just a political reality. But how can we do our best to shift the competitive advantage away from the predator and in the favor of the quail?
You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Dr. Dale Rollins. He's the executive director at the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. They're over there in Texas doing a great job, learning the stuff that will ultimately help us all in one way or another. Dale, I got to ask, so this feed you're talking about is, in effect, it's a I'll call it a vaccine for the eye worm. Is that an adequate description for it?
It'll be a medicated feed with a anthelmintic in it, which when the birds ingest it, it'll kill both the eye worm and the cecal worm. And then where we've got to see is what kind of a efficacy and what kind of a response do we see after administering that to birds in the wild. So we've still got a couple of hurdles to jump on that. And we've been working on this for about 9 years. It's been a long, complex road to hoe, so to speak. But we're making progress, and we're optimistic, cautiously optimistic, again, that it's going to be a game changer.
Well, good luck on that, and we'll keep our fingers crossed for sure. Let's get down to brass tacks on some of the stuff that's important to we as conservationists and hunters, as opposed to you serious biologist types. What if you had to describe perfect bobwhite quail habitat, what are the elements?
Well, first let me say that most of my career, I was an extension wildlife specialist, an outreach specialist for Texas A&M University. And so I traveled all across West Texas, South Texas, giving programs to landowners saying, you know, if you want your quail habitat to promote more quail, these are the things you need to think about. And probably the most popular tool that came out of that is what I call the softball habitat evaluation technique. Shit. Be careful with pronunciation. And what this is, everybody's played slow pitch softball. Now, if I tell a cowboy or a rancher in West Texas that I'd like to have 50 square feet of woody cover every 125 feet, and I'd like to have grass about 18 inches tall, but I'd like to have interspersion of brush and grass, some of that's just going to be glossing over. It's not a complex puzzle, but it'll gloss over. But if I talk to them about softball and I say, okay, how many people have tried to play slow pitch softball? Everybody has. And then I'll say, how many players are on a softball team? Defensive players. They'll first say 9, but I'll correct them. I'll say, no, 10. There's a rover out there. So I want you to visualize. I want you to visualize that landscape to where you see that softball complex. And everywhere that there's a defensive player, I want there to be some kind of shrub. Now, these are what generically I call quail houses. And it would be something like a plum thicket. It could be a little leaf sumac. A lot of different brush species can fill that component. But you've got that out there. So that gives you the visual idea of what it should look like. And then I tell them, okay, now you're the pitcher. And you're the pitcher and you're holding that softball. Well, that softball is a quail. It's about the same size as a quail. And it has about the same dilemmas as a quail, because every time it's exposed, somebody's trying to whack it or eat it. And the quail has the same dilemmas kind of thing. So we talk about that, and that a quail should not, if you were to toss the softball 46 feet pitching distance, and if you can still see the quail or see the softball at that point, you've got insufficient grass cover. So that's one of our biggest issues in West Texas, is our stocking rates often get too high, and we endure a drought and low cattle markets. And so therefore our country just gets overgrazed more often than it needs to. And so by doing that, and by giving the landowner something that they can appreciate and palpate like that, it's really helped them to appreciate what good quail habitat should look like. And I tell people it's cowboy approved, because I, after a field day one time, this cowboy walked up to me, said, until you told us about that softball technique, he said, I didn't really understand what the boss man was looking for. I know what kind of habitat he's looking for, because he was an absentee landowner, but running cattle. So therefore he was more appreciative of what the boss was really wanting.
Well, you were a teacher as well as I was. And I remember the teacher who taught me how to teach said, take them from where they are to where you want them to be.
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing. Dale Rollins, we're just getting warmed up around here, and I'm kind of astounded at how similar your description just now is for so many other game birds out there. There really are some fundamental elements to that habitat. And I was living it again over the weekend in Chucker in Valley Quail Country. And the overgrazing, again, seemed to be one of the bigger issues. And granted, Texas has more public land, I mean, private land than where I usually hunt. But can you do anything on the on the private land besides beg and plead with these guys to manage it better?
Absolutely. The ethics of land ownership and of wildlife, those are very important to most Texas landowners.
Uh-huh.
I'll often tell ranchers that a quail's best friend is a rancher with bird dog, because if they've got a bird dog, then they're evaluating their daily management decisions as it relates to both their vocation and their avocation. Now, if they don't have interest in a bird dog, they're just seeing it on one side there, and that grass is just more grass I'm consuming with my cattle, more profit I can make. But if they're involved and interested in quail, they understand that there are some trade-offs there. And if they won't have quail there, they've got to adjust and address those trade-offs.
Stay with me, Dale Rollins, with the, pardon me, now you've got me doing it, Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. Got a moment or two of break here. The rest of you stick around. We're just getting warmed up on the strategic side of quail hunting. And we have another species to talk about as well. It's all coming up real soon right here on the Upland Nation podcast. First, a message or two from our sponsors, including Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food. Learn more at drtims.com. Soon you'll be seeing a video I did that kind of lays out the Dr. Tim's philosophy of what's important in a dog food. Well, I can tell you from personal experience, yet again, Flick is on the program, and he is doing a great job. This time of year, he's doing anywhere from 15 to 30 miles a day when we hunt chuckers and quail out there in the West. And he is doing very well because he has a strong foundation built on Dr. Tim's dog food. He calls it performance dog food for a reason. Dogs perform. This time of year is when the rubber meets the road. One aspect of that is the fat in a performance dog food. That is where most of the short-term energy comes from. Short-term being you eat it, you get energy that day, the next day. Chicken fat is the most easily metabolized fat, and it also has natural preservatives. No need for all those nasty chemicals in some of the other dog foods out there when you're doing it right with chicken fat. That's what Dr. Tim uses. Quick reminder, 30% discount on your first order. Use the code UPLANDNATION. Tell them I sent you at drtims.com. And if you're telling him I sent you at Dr. Tim's, it's because you heard this message and you probably are protecting your hearing. Hopefully with ESP, electronic shooters protection, electronic earplugs. You can learn more at espamerica.com. Yeah. I'll tell you more about that hunt real soon because it was spectacular. But I heard those birds flying away at 200 yards because I was wearing my ESP electronic earplugs. And I did hear a couple bad jokes about my shooting, but they were way down at the bottom of the hill while I was up at the top. Yeah, I will hold that against you on our next trip, Dave. 30-day money-back trial at espamerica.com. Get fitted locally, in the privacy of your local audiologist's office. It comes with the project. No extra charge for that. Just go to the dealer locator page, espamerica.com, and type in your address. All right, speaking of that hunting trip, I know I brag on Flick a lot, and here's another chance to do it in our Handle It segment from the Cabela's Podcast Studio. We finally got to the top and literally climbed over a little cliff that had a few broken spots. And on the top was where we actually ultimately found the chuckers. Not very many, but there were some out there, and they were doing a good job of staying away from us. until I turned to talk to my buddy and I said, hey, that's Flick on Point. Luckily, we had about 320 yards to discuss our strategy once we got there because they were a long way off, and knock wood, Flick was holding that point very well. And I remembered that if we want those birds to fly in a direction where we can actually shoot at them, let's flank that dog, one go right, one go left, approach from away from the dog, and if possible, even circle kind of inward and kind of perform a pincher movement on the birds so that they're between us and the dog. Sure enough, it worked. Not well enough. We drew feathers on one bird, went over the cliff. We spent another hour looking for that bird. I don't think it ever slowed down. Well, it was fun anyway. Flick, good job. Thank you all for listening. If you'd like more tips like that, they're all over the findbirdhuntingspots.com web pages. Enjoy the tips and offer up a few of your own. Dr. Dale Rollins with the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. Welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be back.
Well, we got started on this stuff, and as a 55 years of experience quail hunter, you probably have some suggestions about how to do this stuff. Let's start with quail habitat. You know, everybody I talk to, and we discuss this every time I'm out in the field, you know, if only somebody would tell me at 9 o'clock they're going to be here, and at 11 o'clock they're going to be here, and at 14 o'clock they're going to be here. Are there any reliable habits that a quail will have during the hunting season?
Well, yes. No, they won't necessarily be absolute because they will change daily on the weather systems and so forth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In general, they're going to break roost around 7 o'clock in the morning. They'll probably, if it's cold, they're going to kind of stay covied up there probably until 7:30, 7:45, and then they'll begin to wander off and begin to feed at that point in time. And typically that feeding, again, if it's cold, that feeding is going to only pick up in duration during the day. If it's a warm day and their food needs are not that high, that's the toughest time to pattern quail. Mm-hmm. But cold day, and probably the very best time to go is like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because sometimes quail won't feed in the morning. But sure. Rarely do you ever see them miss an evening meal. And so the more active they are searching, the more scent your dogs will be finding. And so typically, I like to think that if I see 6 coveys in the morning, I'm expecting to see 12 in the afternoon. I expect my afternoon hunt to double whatever my morning hunt was.
Wow. Well, you know, you got access to the good stuff. Some of us are grateful for 12 coveys in a season, but that's another story. You know, again, I live on the desert. Most of the birds I hunt are desert birds. Any truth to the rumor that bobwhites need what I'll call live water every day?
No, they need water. All animals need water, but the quail will get most of the water they need from the dew that's on plants, from the metabolic water that they get when they're ingesting greens or ingesting insects. And then they will use free water, water from a trough, water from a stream or whatever, but they don't have to have it if those other sources of water are there. So water is something that's, and again, as you move west and you get into Gambell's country and so forth, that in blue quail country, that water is going to be more important to you because it's a more xeric habitat kind of thing.
Yeah.
But even in like, it's very dry in West Texas right now, and I was looking at some crop contents from a colleague of mine sent me last night, and there's a little spindly cactus across much of West Texas called Tasajia, jumping cactus or pencil cactus, and it has little red fruits on it. And if you're looking for a place to find blue quail in West Texas this year, you look out for the Tasajia stands that you can find. And in this particular one last night, they'll have the little red berries, but this one didn't have red berries, but it had 15 or 20 tips of those stem segments. And so you'd think, well, what in the world would quail be getting out of those? Well, they're getting moisture out of them.
Yeah.
Probably not
yeah.
to it, but they're getting, they're using it for food moisture. I'm sorry, using it for moisture.
Funny thing, out here in the West, we find the same, I'll bet a berry that could be confused with the tassajilla that is actually a rose hip kind of a thing, and they'll get into that. The valleys will do that all the time. I remember hunting a draw once, several times one year, where there was one valley quail under every wild rose bush. I don't know if they sent the memo out or it was just mere coincidence, but it happened more than once. Beyond those food sources, are there any in particular that we could be looking for, generally speaking, as a matter of course, during hunting season?
Well, first of all, you're looking for really any kind of a weedy forb, as we'd call them, you know, a broadleaf weed that's producing seed, whether that be a pigweed seed or a doveweed seed. Anything that's producing a seed like that, quail are going to probably be eating it. So as you shoot a couple of birds, one of the first things I ever do is I get a bird in the hand as I pop that crop content open and spread those contents out. And I've studied quail a long time, so I know what most of those seeds are. And that's my backdoor botany, you know. So if I see something that's got a lot of wolfberry fruits in it, well, then I know I want to be looking on the landscape for where the wolfberry is occurring, because that's one of the key focal areas for quail right now. Again, especially we're in a tough year. We've been in three tough years out here. So the tougher the situation gets, the fewer the quail we had to find. So the smarter you got to be to begin to identify what those plants that they deem important and be able to hone in on those as you're looking for the birds.
And you know, you bring that up, and you know what the seeds to some of those plants look like, but I'm going to give you a great example of how we need to dig just a little deeper as hunters to help ourselves in that regard. I was hunting valley quail along a certain river I can't name because it was somebody else's, but I kept finding these little very dark colored, fairly good sized seeds in these quail crops. And I couldn't figure out what the heck it was until I was walking through a stand of what we call Canada thistle. And they all have kind of a bulbous kind of a top to them. And if you brush against them, and you can't help but not when they're as thick as they are out there, you'd hear them rattle just like a maraca. So I cracked one of those open, and sure enough, that's where the seeds were. So these birds are either finding those on the ground, or they're knocking them down, or they're tearing apart those little bulbs, whatever it is. So, you know, it probably makes good sense, even if we're not a PhD, to open up some of these plants and see what the innards look like. Would that be worthwhile for most of us?
Well, I always recommend that all hunters become what I call students of quail. And a student of quail doesn't mean you're after a master's degree, and it just means that you have a penchant for learning more about that bird, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and being able to synthesize what that story is. And that's by reading the landscape, learning to read the landscape. And you're going to learn to read the landscape by the knowledge of those plants. And so I always encourage people to learn a plant a week. I say take off, learn a plant a week, and I'll give you 2 weeks off at Christmas. If you know 50 plants at the end of the year, you'll be the most botanically literate person that you hunt with.
I love it. We made a joke to each other just on Sunday on our last hunt. I said, you know, we're kind of like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. We're ostensibly hunting, but we're poking around and digging in the dirt and finding and bringing it home. Like it or not, there's always something in the vest that they don't really care to see, but they're going to see it anyway because we found it. Can we shoot out a covey, or is that just a myth from the old days? What are the biggest population impacts on a covey of quail?
All right, you can shoot out a covey now, and one of the things, as quail numbers go down, historically, hunting would have been self-limiting. In other words, mm-hmm. if it was a 4-year like it is this year, I might say, well, Dallas Cowboys ain't very good, but I believe I'll stay home this Sunday and watch them as opposed to chasing blues. But if there's a lot of quail, then it's compensatory, and it's really not that big a deal. But with today, at least in Texas again, at least in Texas, the value of quail hunting, and especially to people out of state, and this is unpalatable perhaps to most of your listeners, because if you're going to hunt in Texas, you're probably going to have to be paying somebody for access to get on there. And so if you've got quail hunting that is free, all of a sudden, if it gets pretty poor, you're probably not coming back. But if you've paid $2,000 for a quail lease, and your wife says, "Well, by golly, you spent that money, don't you think you need to be out there hunting quail?" The self-regulatory nature of quail hunting is not the same when we've got a very valuable game bird. And you've probably been out around Patagonia, Arizona, some of that. You know how much hunter traffic there is out there, even in a bad year. So there's it can be negative. It's not always neutral.
Yeah, there is that attitude that I paid for a limit, I'm going to get a limit no matter what. Are there other things that have a major effect on quail, let's say during the off season? Predators, what number one, and which are the biggest, but weather and things like that, are there other population impacts that will help us understand quail conservation?
Well, in the Southwest, weather is the number one factor. And again, when you're going through 3 years like we've come through, and low cattle prices, and I mean, I've been across New Mexico all the way up to Wyoming, and that country looks as hard as I've ever seen it right now because of low cattle prices and dry weather. So that's a big thing. And the ability to use cattle as a tool is very attractive, but it's got to be used as a tool and not just have cows and quail at the same time. And it can be done like that, but if you've got one guy with an interest in the cows and another guy with an interest in the quail, again, you've probably got a recipe for headaches there. As far as predation and so forth, the quails, every living, breathing moment is dictated by the threat of predation. Now, it doesn't mean we go out and nuke all the predators. What it says, we've got to think about every day, what is the quail hiding from today? How are they going to cope with the fact that bobcats are let's use Cooper's hawks, Accipiter hawks, which will be migrating down this way in October. And boy, that becomes a rough neighborhood when them and the northern harriers get here, because they're two very astute predators on the bobwhite and blue quail.
Don't get me started. I just hope they migrate real soon, because I'm sick and tired of them standing outside my pigeon coop waiting for me to open the door. Does rain make quail if it's at the right time of the year?
I would say yes. I mean, without rain at the right time of year, you're not going to be able to raise your quail, because I want you to think of a quail. I often have a group of landowners, and I'll have them each one holding a cube of ice in their hands. And I'll say, "All right, that's your quail population. Study it for 1 minute and tell me what's happening." And after 1 minute, I'll say, "All right, what's happening to your population?" They said, "It's melting." Well, that's what quail do, they melt. And if we don't get new ice in every so often, we're in a world of hurt really soon. So we've got to have the ice, in the form of, not ice, but we've got to have rain, which in our analogy here is providing ice cubes and so forth. The other thing is, and I want to go back to the predation standpoint just a little bit, there are two major threats. You've got your mesocarnivores. These are the everything from a coyote down to a badger, raccoon, that kind of thing. And then you've got the raptors. Now, the raptors, in our studies over the last 12 years, the raptors have accounted for about 30% of our winter mortality, and then maybe only 15% of our summer mortality. Our mammalian predators are much more important to us during the summer, and there are much worse nest predators. And I always take a nest predator more seriously than I do one that takes one bird at a time, because when they take out a clutch of 14 eggs, that gets me upset. So there's a lot that you can do. And Scott, I've got a lot of, if we reference our website, quailresearch.org, we've got a whole lot of webisodes, probably 35 different little YouTube webisodes on all the topics that we're going to cover today. You can dial into those. We have our own podcast series too. So we'll be talking about, you know, brush control and quail, and how it can work for you or how it can work against you. And then we have a monthly eQuail newsletter that I write every month. You know, all those are free. You can sit in your recliner and watch them in your comfort of your Bermuda shorts and with a cup of coffee.
All of that at quailresearch.org. That is the website for the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. You also have a pretty active Facebook page. That's looking good, and you're sure enlightening me today. Dr. Dale Rollins with the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden. If we could do one thing as hunters, Dale, to help the cause, what would that be?
Well, it would be support, collaborate, engender the support of the landowners. And that takes several forms. One is, if it's on public land, you know, we've all seen public land's been trashed out. So be a good example from that standpoint. If it's on private land, it's probably going to be taken care of, because again, you're paying a lease fee for that, and there's a clause in there that tells you got to keep that thing cleaned up. But then also, I think, like I said, the best friend a quail has is a cowboy with bird dogs. And if we had more cowboys, more ranchers were using bird dogs or having been exposed to quail, that's something that, in my opinion, we've missed the boat on. And as a result, they're into team roping and tie down calf roping and those kinds of things, but they don't have any interest in quail. Well, quail are not going to be very high on their list of interest. And it goes even further than that, in that many of our state game biologists are not quail hunters. Mm-hmm. In Texas, they hunt elk, they hunt deer, they hunt waterfowl, but very few of them have bird dogs. I could tell you about five parks and wildlife biologists in the state of Texas that have bird dogs. And that's a shame to me, because if we want to get more passion built into those younger biologists, we've got to get them opportunities to again get a bird dog and enjoy the finer points of quail hunting with bird dogs.
I can't agree more. I'm thinking of some spots I hunted last season, actually, and even once this season, that I was taken to by my newer buckaroo friend down there in Southeast Oregon. Thank you, David, for all of that. And he's one of those guys, he's kind of the poster boy for the example you just made. He runs cows down in that country and decided a bird dog was a good idea about 4 or 5 years ago. And poof, all of a sudden we got a guy who looks out for both his cows and his quail and his chucker too, luckily. And then he shares them with me. Let's switch gears here, Dr. Dale Rollins. You know blue quail pretty well also. And, you know, we call them blue quail, we call them cotton tops, we call them scalies. Well, tell us a little bit about how they differ from bobwhites.
Well, physically, they're about a half ounce heavier than bobwhites are. You will find bobwhites and blue quail running in the same covey. You will find them occupying the same range. That's what we call sympatric, when their ranges overlap like that. They will eat about the same diet. I did my master's degree back in 1980 on bobwhite and blue quail in southwestern Oklahoma. and was measuring, you know, what kind of foods do they eat? Did they eat similar foods? And yes, they do. They eat just about the same things. A blue quail will nearly always have 3 to 5 times more seeds in its crop than what a bobwhite does. They are a better hustler. Val Lehman, who was a biologist for the King Ranch many years ago, once said that blue quail are somewhat more intelligent than bobwhites. And I think most people that have hunted them would agree. They're a great complement to bobwhite. I always like to think of them as drought insurance because they don't boom quite as well in the good years as what the blues did. I'm sorry, the bobwhites. But then they don't bust quite as badly in the poor years as the bobwhites did. So they make a nice little bit of drought insurance, if you will. They're a truly a trophy quail. I say that every quail is a trophy, but sometimes, for example, a Montezuma quail or a covey of blues, those are just, they're trophy quail. And because it requires different techniques, and you begin to appreciate them for what they are. You appreciate them for how they scrabble out a living in some really hard country. And so you've got to have an appreciation for that. And then it's just another one of those, you know, it's just another petal in the flower, the quail flower out there that you'd like to be able to say, I have not hunted all 6 species of quail. I've hunted 4, and the other 2 are still on my bucket list. But just being able to enjoy the diversity and the different kinds of country that you hunt them in, like I said, it's like Technicolor when you're hunting.
I want to ask what's on your bucket list, and I'm telling you that now so that I remember to ask that again, because the first thing I want to know is you mentioned water and you mentioned smarts when it comes to blues. Every time I've shot a blue quail, it's been within 100 yards of a stock tank. I won't go into all the other strategies we use because I'm going to ask you about that in a minute, but they're not there all the time, are they?
Well, they're there. They're attracted to 2 things in the water's part of it. If you think about a windmill or a water trough that you've come across in New Mexico or wherever that's being grazed by livestock, the concentration of those grazing animals around those watering points creates a different complement of plants, things like cowpen daisy. And so the heavier stocking use and so forth and the soil disturbance of those hooves, that's basically the same as if we were pulling a tandem disc through bobwhite country and we're stimulating the types of seeds that quail will be the plants that are producing seeds that quail are find attractive.
Okay, good. All right. I'm glad to hear that. The other thing about my blue quail hunting has always been it's almost a run and gun situation. We've tried to put dogs on the ground and do that, you know, the traditional way, and it must work some places, but most of the time it's not the same, but it's almost road hunting. You're driving from somewhere to somewhere, you're piling out, and then you're running with an open, unloaded gun as far as you can before you get to the birds. Is that kind of the standard blue quail hunting technique?
That's pretty common in Texas. It's kind of the Roman chariot race. And so, yeah, that's pretty common. Now, I tell you, especially over the last 3 or 4 years, we've hunted more and more blue quail because our bobwhite number has been down, and we're hunting more and more blue quail in a non-traditional way. We're hunting them with bird dogs. And I would say 2 years ago, we had as good a season for hunting blue quail behind bird dogs and having points. Because if we saw perhaps 15 coveys that day, we might have had points on 8 of them. And that's pretty impressive for blue quail because, as you know, most of the time they're running, flushing wild and that kind of thing. There's a technique that my buddy Steve, he's the guy that has the better bird dogs with me, and we call it the Steve Sherrod back assward attempt to hunting blue quail. So typically when you're chasing blue quail, you're following them into the wind. You're hunting upwind, and you rarely ever catch up with them. because by the time you get up there, the dog's pulling them. By the time you get there, they're flushing wild. So what we've learned to do sometimes is just turn around and hunt them downwind. And your dogs will be out there 150, 200 yards ahead of you, and they're going to run by those blue quail, and then they're going to basically turn around and point them in between the dogs and you. I think I heard you refer to it as a pincher movement a while ago.
Yeah.
That works pretty well. If there are quail out there, you can get them separated. You know, I mean, sometimes with blue quail, you'll have coveys of 60 to 80 birds. And until you can get those coveys down into more manageable units, 5 to 15, they're going to run you to death. So even if your dogs scatter them some and then you begin to hunt back into the wind down there, where, you know, going back to your camp or whatever, that's a pretty productive way to hunt blue quail.
I love it. We usually do that only because we want to get back for happy hour, and that means walking downwind instead of upwind. But I've seen that work in the past. In fact, at least once last weekend I saw that work, and it paid off too. So good boy, Flicky. He's in the back of the room here, just hanging on my every word, as you might be able to tell. All right, so you said four of the six, the other two are on my bucket list. What are those two bucket list quail for you, Dr. Dale Rollins?
Those will be the mountain quail and the California quail.
Come on down. I'll put you in both anytime. Yeah. In fact, there are times when I'll jump a covey that has both.
If we ever recreate what we had in 2014 through 17, hook me up, Scott. I've hunted quail for 55 years, really prior to about 1986, I didn't know there was ever such thing as a poor quail year. Some might be better than others, but beginning in 2015-16, we were routinely pointing 40 to 70 coveys of Bob Whites and blue quail. And again, maybe a third of them being blues and two thirds of them being Bob Whites. That was just I tell people I've climbed the mountain and I've seen the other side and I want to go back.
Yeah. Well, I understand that. I can only visualize that in my mind. Like I said, sometimes that's several seasons worth of covey rises for a guy out here in the West, but I sure would love to see a little bit more of that happening. You know, we've talked a lot about quail and a little bit about dogs, but you've been around dogs of various sorts for quite a while here. If you were to leave us with one more bit of advice about hunting quail with dogs, what would it be?
Trust your dogs.
Yeah.
Trust your dogs. I tell you, my dogs typically, my set of my betters typically would run maybe 200 yards ahead of me and back and forth across the landscape. You know, again, just one of the beautiful poetry and motion kind of things that sitters do for you.
Dale Rollins, you've been hunting quail with bird dogs for 55 years. If you were to leave us with one bit of advice about how to use your dog, how to work with your dog better, what would that advice be?
Well, this better that I had named Susie, that since then I'm kind of a philosopher from time to time, and I wrote a little ditty called Susie's 12-Point Plan for Success. And based on life lessons that I've learned with Susie at my side. And the first one is that you always hunt with good dogs. And I mean, you always spend time with your dogs. They are your best friends. You always spend time with your best friends that are smarter and faster than you. And you're going to be better off just by associating with those people. So always hunt with good dogs. And then being able to get those dogs out as much as you can. I mean, reps make the dog. And again, it's been a tough year for us here in West Texas, but if people will ask me, they say, how many flushes did it take? How many points did it take to get a dog like you've got there? And I'll think about it just a second and I'll say, oh, about 100. And if you can get that in the first 2 weeks, that's all the better. So just giving them the opportunity to get those reps in and learn, because a bird, you know, a bird dog, you're just watching them and you just revel in how much they learn and how much they can teach you if you're willing to be taught.
There you go. Tell your spouse you just need to get that dog out more often on more birds, more bird contacts. The doctor's orders. Dr. Right. Dale Rollins, I sure had a hell of a good time with you. I sure appreciate your spending some time with us. If you want to learn more about what Dale and everybody on the team is doing out there at the Rolling Plains Quail Research Foundation, go to quailresearch.org. Or just look them up on the Facebook pages and learn all about what they're doing in the world of conservation based around quail. Nice to see the bird at the top of the pyramid. Love that philosophy. The rest of you are going to stick around. I've still got this land is your land. Among other things, we're going to talk all about public access and a few other things as well. So stick around. But Dr. Dale Rollins, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Yes, thank you, Scott.
Just a quick reminder that the newsletter poll, the Upland Nation Insights newsletter poll, is sponsored by Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies, skin, coat, parasites, fleas, and ticks. They've got a remedy for every one of those, among others, including Flix pads, which I'm pretty darn proud of. I shouldn't even talk about it. Learn more at happyjackinc.com. That's happyjackinc.com. Yeah, talking about the newsletter, if you haven't gotten it, sign up at findbirdhuntingspots.com every week, in addition to all the other good stuff, hopefully, that you can use over the weekend. I ask a question and I get your answers, and quite often they are very enlightening, including this one. And this is probably a weird year to ask this, but I'm still very encouraged. The question was, do you hunt outside your own state most seasons? And, you know, granted, it's been different this year for everybody in so many ways, but still 48% of you said, yes, I'm hunting out of state sometime in the season. 51.5% or so percent said, nope, stick closer to home. And I understand all of those rationales. So good to learn, good to know. All right, This Land Is Your Land is coming up after this message from Gunner Kennels. Well, they're not even Gunner Kennels anymore. I guess that's a good way to put it. Gunner.com. The reason is they got so many other things these days, from accessories for your kennel to Gunner gear, hoodies, hats, t-shirts, and gift cards if you're still searching for that ultimate gift for your hunting buddy or yourself. You can get one at gunner.com. While you're there, watch some of the videos. Look at the extensive testing they do. That's why they build such great products. Take the Fit Finder quiz and even crowdsource your new Gunner dog crate. It's all at gunner.com. This Land Is Your Land, brought to you by findbirdhuntingspots.com. New material every week to help you find places to hunt, train, and care for your dog. Most of them public access. Well, the dogs aren't public access. You know what I mean, though. Yeah. One of the places that I love, not only because there's some great pheasant hunting, but because the people are unbelievably nice, and there's some history, and there's some other things that a traveling spouse might enjoy. All of those take place in and around the Dodge City, Kansas vicinity. Yeah, that Dodge City where the gunfights and the legendary Western characters from Wyatt Earp to Doc Holliday spent their free time. Plus all of the great public land that's available to you in the walk-in hunting access program in Kansas. You can learn more by going to ksoutdoors.com. Find that area on the map. Get a quick look at all the private and public land open to hunting at no charge. It's all in Dodge City, Kansas, and the vicinity. The up. Nation podcast is brought to you in part by ESPAmerica.com. Electronic earplugs. I'm a believer. I wear them in the range and I wear them in the field, both. And you ought to think about doing the same thing. Can't thank you enough for listening. Can't thank Dale Rollins enough for giving us all those insights into blue and Bob White quail. I hope you learned something. I know I sure did. Maybe we can all band together and get him out here to show him some valley quail and some mountain quail hunting. If you like the Upland Nation podcast, do me a big favor. Rate it and review it, especially if you are an Apple Podcast subscriber. But anywhere you get it, please review and rate us. It does help, and I would appreciate it. You want to talk anytime, it's the Upland Nation Facebook page or the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. Thanks for your recent reviews, Old Pro Bird Hunter, Gamer Boy 527, and Skips. I think I get it, Skips. The spelling is funny, but it's pretty good. All right, I'll leave you with this quote from Mabel Louise Robinson. She says, from the dog's point of view, his master is an elongated and abnormally cunning dog. I'll consider that a compliment. You probably will too. Thanks again for listening. I'm Scott Linden. I'll see you next in the field.